Growing up in the church, I heard this question at the beginning of almost every holy day. Why are we here? Our neighbors here in the child care center are probably wondering, we know they come in every Saturday, but why are they here on a Monday? Why are we gathered on a Monday? Why are we here? Let's notice Leviticus chapter 23. Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 24. And I think we all know why we're here. Leviticus 23 is a listing of all of the holy days in one chapter. Leviticus 23, verse 24. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, as we read earlier over in the book of Numbers, you shall have a Sabbath rest, a memorial of blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. We've already talked about this a bit, but one of the reasons we're here is because God tells us to be here. I'm assuming that's one of the reasons all of you made the effort to be here today on a Monday, is because God asks us to be here. Verse 25, you shall do no customary work on it, and you shall make an offering made by fire to the Lord. And we read about that in a little more detail over in Numbers chapter 29. So I'm not going to repeat all that, but as a pastor, as a minister who gives sermons on God's holy days, the topics one could choose for trumpets are many. I have many choices to talk about today. What do we talk about? The resurrection, which occurs at the sound of the trumpet, the time of the end. Do we talk about the trumpets leading up to the final seventh trumpet and those prophecies which could be covered? And I've heard them covered on the Feast of Trumpets. I thought about this quite a bit in looking at all of the various topics that I could have covered or could have selected, and of course prayed about it. And I'd like to talk about one of the most important themes and purposes for why we're here today, and what we're here to remember, and what we're here to think about. I lived for about 5 years in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, a beautiful town nestled at the foothills of the Rockies. And several times a year, you could feel a breeze in the air, a little breeze coming from the west. It was coming over the Rockies and would blow down across the beginning of the plains and Calgary, Alberta. That breeze indicated that there was something coming, something that they called the Chinook winds. And the Chinook winds would either in the fall of the year bring cold weather and possibly snow to Calgary, or in the fall of the year, the spring of the year, they could bring a warm wind. And I remember one time going into the mall. The malls there were, a lot of them, even grocery stores were indoors because it snowed a lot in the wintertime. But you could go into the mall. One time, I remember this, you'd go into the mall, and if you were in there for maybe an hour or two shopping and just spending time out of the weather in the mall, and you would come out of the mall and the temperature could change 40 degrees. I remember one time we went in, there was snow on the ground, and we came out an hour and a half later, and the temperature had changed 40 degrees, 40 degrees warmer, snow was melting, sun was out, and we knew this was coming because of the Chinook winds that would blow in. It can be either a pretty nice or a pretty bad phenomenon, depending on which end of those Chinooks you're at. But I learned over the 5 years we were there, when a Chinook wind starts to blow, when you feel the wind blowing, you know that something's coming. Well, there are doctrinal changes coming. Not I'm pleased to say, in the Church of God, a worldwide association. But there are other doctrinal changes coming. I feel the Chinook winds. So I thought it would be appropriate to talk about this particular topic I'd like to address today. Let's begin by going to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 14. Romans 8:14 describes by the pen of Paul the reason we're here today. I'm going to get right to the topic. Romans chapter 8, verse 14. Paul writes, "For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, these are sons of God." What I'm going to talk about today is the family of God. The family of God. Most of us take this for granted, this teaching, this doctrine, that this day represents in many ways. But it should not be taken for granted because it tells us something about the nature of God. Verse 15, "For you did not receive the spirit of bondage," again to fear, "but you received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry, Abba, Father," Daddy, Father. The relationship that we have with God is because He considers us His sons. And because we are considered His sons and we understand that, we can now have a relationship that's very close to the Father. We can call Him Dad because we understand that God is a family. God is a family. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit, that is God's spirit, with our human spirit, that we are children of God. He repeats that phrase again, children of God. And if children, then heirs. Then he begins to explain, if we're children in the family and God is going to be giving gifts to His children, we're like heirs, heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. So in some ways we're going to be equal to Christ as joint heirs, if indeed we suffer with Him, that we may also be glorified together. The promise is that we're going to be glorified just as Christ was glorified. He adds in verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us," or through us. I don't know how you feel of going to funerals and hearing the preacher sometimes. Am I hearing sounds or is that music? Oh, okay. Just checking. At my age, you never know, you know. But getting back to my topic, the family of God and joint heirs with Jesus Christ and being glorified. When I go to a funeral, sometimes I hear the minister who's there, I'm not talking about church funerals, and he says that so-and-so is up in heaven. And my temptation is, what's he doing there? Have you ever thought about that? And you have this urge to ask, okay, he's going to be in heaven, what's he doing there? And if you want to see a blank stare on somebody's face, ask that question. I don't know. You know, people used to say, well, we're going to play harps. Okay, I enjoy harp music occasionally, but I can't imagine a 24/7 job playing harps. There are other religions that say you're going to be in the vision, the beatific vision of God. You can look at God all day. Okay. I want to see God. I want Him to see me, right? But to just sit in a chair and look at God all day, I mean, I don't know about you, but I kind of get bored watching the same movie twice, right? The answers just don't make sense. There's a lady in our community who has a little dog. And whenever we're walking our dogs, we often run into each other. And she's a little absent-minded. She's lived in our community for 29 years, and I'll probably be that way if I live there 29 years. But every time she sees our little Yorkie, she goes, "Oh, there's my little Yorkie." And she's remembering back. She had a little Yorkie who died. And she always goes, "Oh, there's my little Yorkie. You've come back from heaven." And it just kind of tears your heart out, because she really believes, as absent-minded as she is, or suffering from a little bit of Alzheimer's probably. I think she's in her upper 80s. Nice little lady. She's always friendly. But every time we greet her, there's her memory of her little dog, which must have looked a lot like our little dog. Or maybe she thinks he was reincarnated. I don't know exactly, but oh, he came back from heaven. What are the dogs doing in heaven? I mean, you know, your imagination kind of goes wild. If they're going to go to heaven, what are they doing? When we're glorified, what will we be doing? Paul writes in verse 18, "For I consider that the sufferings at this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us." There's going to be a glorification of our bodies. Paul writes about that in Philippians. He says our bodies are going to be changed. They're going to become spirit. Notice verse 19, "For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. At the seventh trump, when Christ returns and the seventh trump is sounded, we're going to be changed or resurrected into glorified bodies." And God calls that, through the pen of Paul, the revealing of the sons of God. The glorification that takes place. We will take on the same properties that Christ did when he was resurrected from the dead. In verse 20, Paul writes, "For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." Right now, we are all subject to the bondage of corruption. We read in the announcement sections the death of another member. Or two, you know, whenever I publish the updates that we get from headquarters. We know that this life is temporary, and you and I are temporary, and we know we're subject to dying. Not long ago, I had gallbladder surgery, and the doctor told me, he says, "Dave, your gallbladder was dead, no longer functioning, and it's a good thing I took it out. Because if you have a gallbladder attack, it could infect your peritoneum, and you could die from that." So I had my diseased organ taken out. And I said, "Well, doc, why was my gallbladder diseased?" And he kind of shrugged his shoulders. And he said, "Dave, you're getting older." Our organs wear out, right? If you get a car that's got 500,000 miles on it, the parts are going to start wearing out, right? There are people who believe, you know, if you eat enough, well, whatever, you know, or not enough of that, or not some of that, that your organs might survive for a year or two longer. I mean, I don't know what the theory is, but nobody that I know of has been able to beat death and the deterioration of our human bodies, because we are subject to corruption. It happens. It just happens. And it happens sometimes to young people, to old people. Linda and I have a very good friend, or had a very good friend, who often went to Hawaii for the feast. Very talented young lady. She and her mother would go to the feast. 54 years old. Very fastidious about her diet, ran every day, was an athlete, 54 years old, as she was getting ready to go running, fell over in her bathroom, dead. An aneurysm. Don't know the cause. She just keeled over dead. Left her 80-some-year-old mother, whom she was taking care of, now to fend for herself. Actually, she has brothers and sisters to help support her mom, but they were living close to each other so that she could take care of her mom in her old age. Very sad, but there's no, you know, kind of rhyme or reason, is there? Sometimes the healthiest people, just something gives out in the body. You know, in this case, the arteries probably hardened up, unbeknownst to her knowledge, through heredity or whatever, and she died at an early age. At least, I don't know how you think about it, but I think of 54 as an early age. It happens because we are subject to deterioration, subject to death. Verse 20, the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. That's why we're here today, the hope of the resurrection, the glorification of our body, but something much more important to that, and I'm going to get to it in a minute, for the creation, that's verse 21, because the creation itself will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, that is, the redemption of our body. For we are saved in this hope. But hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. And this day reminds us that we are eagerly waiting for that day, the revealing of the glory of the sons of God. That's what we're waiting for. In 1965, a fellow by the name of Walter Martin wrote a book called Kingdom of the Cults. Maybe some of you read it, have read it. It's now in its sixth reprinting, so it's a pretty popular book. The Kingdom of the Cults by Walter Martin. Now, Walter Martin is not a theologian. He's not a very good writer, frankly. He's now passed away. But in his Kingdom of the Cults, he wrote about the Church of God. And he labeled us a cult. And one of the doctrines that he pointed out that made us a cult, he kind of singled out several doctrines and attached them to different organizations in his book. And one of those doctrines was the belief that God is a family that is expanding. He believes that is a doctrine of a cult. So identified. He called it heresy in his book. And he said this is one of the cult identifiers. So you and I are in a cult, according to Martin. And one of the reasons is because we believe we are going to be part of the family of God. Of course, Walter Martin believed, like most evangelicals, evangelical writer, that he's going to go to heaven and do... He never described that in his book. He never had a counter argument in his book. He just kind of left that dangling out there. But one of the reasons is what we find in Deuteronomy chapter 6. Let's go there. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. He didn't quote very many scriptures, but one of the scriptures he quotes in his book is what is called the Shema prayer by the Jews. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. There are three monotheistic religions in the world that at least are popularly known. One is the Muslim faith. They believe one God, Allah. Two are the Jews. They believe there is one God, GD, in their writings. and Christianity believes in a monotheistic God, but they believe that God is three in one somehow. Those are the three monotheistic religions of the world: the Jews, the Muslims, and Christians. It's kind of interesting that, among other things, this day pictures the expansion of God's family. From one to one. From one to one. How can that be? Well, Christ explained it in John 17. Let's go there. John 17. In verse 20, because this is actually telling us something about the nature of God and why we believe God is one. John 17, verse 20. Christ himself was praying to the Father here just prior to his crucifixion in John 17. In verse 20, John 17, 20. He says, I do not pray for these alone, talking about the 12, or what turned out to be 120 on that day of Pentecost. I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their work. That's you and me. That work has been passed down for 2,000 years to you and me. Verse 21, that they all may be one. As you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me. So Christ defined what the oneness was, in essence. He said, when two people agree and they come together and they are joined as one, doesn't mean they're both now yellow pencils, right? Or have the same mind meld in some form or another, but they become one. Christ said, Father, you and I are one, and I am praying that you will bring these believers together in a oneness with us. They will be tied to us by your Holy Spirit. They will think as you and I do. They will act as you and I do. They will be one with us. So Christ himself defined the oneness that we read about in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. Doesn't mean one being, it means to be together in oneness. Verse 22, and the glory which you gave me, I have given them. That is, I'm going to give them the Spirit, and that is how this glorification takes place. We read that in Romans 8. That they may be one just as we are one. I in them, you in me, that they may be made perfect or mature in oneness, and that the world may know that you have sent me and love them as you have loved me. So what was intended by the oneness doesn't mean one being or one individual. It means bringing together in the way people cooperate and work. I know when we ask a blessing on a marriage, we ask God to bring these two people together who are exchanging vows. Make them one. In fact, the Bible talks about that, the oneness of marriage. And after many, many years, I know Linda and I have talked about this, we sometimes finish each other's sentences, right? We think along the same lines. I mean, she has a different personality than I do, but as our marriage matures, there's a oneness that develops in a marriage. Is there not? I don't know about you, but when you see people that have been married 50, 60 years, they almost start looking like each other, right? It is a oneness that develops, at least it should, over a period of time. Let's go back to John 1. John chapter 1. John 1 and verse 1. John 1, 1. I don't know how people like Walter Martin and others who write books about the nature of God justify these scriptures here. John 1, 1, it says, "In the beginning was the Word," in the Greek, the Logos, "and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." If you're one, how can somebody be with you? Unless you're together in terms of a oneness or a unity. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God." We acknowledge that there was a pre-existence of the one who became Jesus Christ, who was at one with God, as Christ just said. The oneness that we had, I want you to give that to all the disciples. Once again, this doctrine of the nature of God is festered to the surface, as it has, frankly, for thousands of years. You know, the Catholic Church argued about it for over 100 years, and they finally settled on the Trinity. And, of course, the Trinity, carried forth by the Roman Church and adopted by most of the Protestant churches, is the belief in God, three in one. We don't believe in the Trinity. We also don't believe that Christ was a created being. We believe in a pre-existence that Christ had. And I think this is part of that evidence that you read here. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God." Pretty clear to me. "All things were made through Him, and without Him nothing was made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it or overcome it. There was a man sent from God, whose name was John, and this man came for a witness, to bear witness of this light, and all through him would believe. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. And he came to his own, and his own did not receive him," talking about the Jews, of course. Verse 12, "But as many as received him, to him he gave the right to become children of God." There's that phrase again and that theme. We are called to become children of God, to be born into the God family, just as Christ was resurrected and given eternal life. That's why we're called. "To those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." This is our future, to be part of the family of God. And this day, the Feast of Trumpets, points to that resurrection when we will be glorified and we become part of the family of God. And I'll tell you, like any family, he's got work for us to do. And we will celebrate that during the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll talk about the work that's going to be taken care of for 1,000 years. And we, as the part of the family of God, just as Christ will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, we will serve and work in that kingdom. We will be productive. We will allow more and more to become part of the family of God. God's family will grow large through that experience. I'm not going to turn there, but in Genesis 1, verse 26 and 27, it says that God created man in his image. Again, many of you have had children, and we know how we anticipate the first child, especially. And my wife and I anticipated the birth of our first child, and They finally had to kick me out of the delivery room because I was taking too many pictures. You know, we're really excited about the birth of a new child, and a new child comes into this world. And when you look at the child, of course, the first thing you do is take inventory. You know, 10 fingers, 10 toes. All the limbs are there. They were born into this world whole. But then you start looking at whose eyes does he have, you know? Look, he has your nose. He has your shape of head. It's flat in the back, you know. When they start walking, we say, well, he walked just like you do, or your grandfather, right? As I say frequently to people, well, the apple didn't fall too far from the tree. We look like our parents in many cases, don't we? I remember telling Linda a few years ago, I was getting older and, you know, I was getting those spots on the back of my hands. And I looked down one day when we were riding along and I said, Linda, I've got my dad's hands. I remembered what my father's hands looked like as he was getting older. And I looked down and I go, my hands now look like my dad's hands. We've probably all gone through that experience, right? When God made man in his image, he intended for his children to be in his image. Not something different. Not a part of the angelic world. Not eternal gardeners on the earth. You know, there are all kinds of doctrines out there that are floating around about not only the nature of God, but what man will become. But man was made in the image of God. Why? Because God is love and God is give, and he wanted to share what he's got. Just like us, when we have children today, we want to share with our children what we have. And many of us prepare for that. I know Linda and I prepared for our children to go to school, to go to college. We prepared for them to be on their own when they got out of college. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, right? It's called the boomerang effect. You know, we prepare for our children. We want something better for them than we had. God considers himself a parent. Remember that phrase, Abba, Father? Daddy, Father? That's a concept that most people in the world reject. What we're here today to celebrate, most people in the world reject that. But why did he do that? Do we believe that God has emotions, feelings? Oh, and no doubt. Because we do, and we're made in his image, right? I don't know how many of you remember the song. Maybe some of you do. I'm sure some of you will. You're my generation. It was a song by Three Dog Night, the rock band, entitled One is the Loneliest Number. Remember that? Relax, I'm not going to sing it. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. I won't read all the lyrics, but just let me share a few with you. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number. It's just no good anymore since you went away. He was writing about, not God, but somebody else. But it expresses this emotion. Now I spend my time just making rhymes of yesterday. One is the loneliest number. One is the loneliest number. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest. One is the loneliest. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. I think we get the message, don't we? It's just no good anymore since you went away. One is the loneliest. One is the loneliest. One is the loneliest. I see some of you are remembering the song. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 1. God wanted to share. God the Father and Jesus Christ from the foundations of the earth wanted to share what they had. They wanted to give human beings made in the image of God, who had God's Spirit and developed that character over a lifetime, he wanted to give them what he's got. His power. His eternity. All the things that come with God, his creativity, his life-giving abilities. He wanted to share that. Notice what it says here in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. Hebrews 1:1. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds. We read that earlier in John 1:1. Proving the existence of the one who became Jesus Christ as being with God from the beginning. There were two, but they wanted more in their family. They wanted to expand that family. Verse 3, who being the brightness of his glory and the express image, the Greek icon, of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged out sin, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels. See, our fate is to follow in the footsteps of our elder brother Jesus Christ, to be better and higher than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. You and I will be given that. We're not going to be changed into angels. Something far better. Members of the family of God. Today, on the Day of Trumpets, we pause to think about that wonderful doctrine that we will be part of the family of God when that seventh trumpet blast is blasted in heaven and the dead are resurrected. And we who remain, as Paul said, will be changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye, to become part of the family of God. Notice Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6, right across the page in my Bible. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6. But one testifies in a certain place, he's quoting from Psalms 8, saying, what is man that you're mindful of him? Or the Son of Man, that you should take care of him. You have now made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and with honor, and set him now over the works of your hands. You have put all things now subject under his feet. For in that he put all in subjection under him, he left nothing that is not put under him, but now we do not yet see all things put under him. We know there's a future. We know that Christ will return and he will become King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That hasn't happened yet. But the door, the opening of that begins on the fulfillment of trumpets in the future. Verse 9 now, but we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. For it is fitting for him, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory. He created the pathway by which many sons will be brought to glory. And brethren, that's you and me. We are the sons of God to be brought to glory. The same glory that Jesus Christ experienced, the change into spirit. To make the captain, that is the first one of their salvation, perfect through sufferings. And you and I are being made perfect, mature, through that same process. Experiencing trials. Experiencing the deterioration of these carnal bodies we find ourselves in, living in this world that is only temporary. Now, verse 11. For both he who sanctifies, that is Christ, and those who are being sanctified are all of one. That's the oneness that we seek. That's what we celebrate, is the time when we will be at one with God, at one with Christ, just as they are one, bringing many sons to glory, as it says in verse 10, for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters, I might add. Christ is not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters, because he's called us to the purpose of being part of the family of God. And that's what this day, and I believe this day most importantly, tells us. It also tells us something about the nature of God. God doesn't want to remain one, even in two beings that are thinking alike and joined by the Spirit. He wants to expand that family and make it much bigger. That is hard for the monotheistic believer to contemplate. So people always try to find some sort of justification around that. The winds of doctrinal change are blowing, brethren, and they're blowing against the nature of God. Let's go to 1 John chapter 3. 1 John 3 and verse 1. 1 John 3, 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Not super angels, not cherubim, not something else, but the children of God. And we've talked about that process today. Therefore, the world does not know us, because it did not know him, really. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be completely. It's pretty hard to imagine what we will be without all the encumbrances of this physical life that we're so accustomed to, right? Beloved, now we are children of God, verse 2, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him. Talking about the glorification we've read about earlier. We shall be like him, talking about Christ, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. And again, today is that reminder for us that we are here on earth to become the children of God, to realize that rebirth as spirit, just as Christ experienced. You know, there's one scripture that escaped Walter Martin. It's found back in Psalms 82. Let's go back there, Psalms 82. This world does not understand Psalms 82, verse 6. Psalms 82, verse 6. I said, you are gods. God says, we are gods. We're being developed for the God family. You are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High, but you will die like men. This is the way God made it. Just like Christ died, we will too die or be changed. And fall like even the most elegant of all kings and princes. But verse 8 describes what we're celebrating here today, that there will be a time when we will rise. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all nations. And that's our destiny. That's the fulfillment of the Feast of Trumpets. We will become part of the family of God. We are gods. being prepared to be part of the God family. In conclusion, let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 14. Actually, let's begin reading at verse 13. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 13. Paul wrote, "But I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren." That's why we get these reminders at least once a year about why we're here on earth. "I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep or who have died. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first. And then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And thus we shall always be with the Lord." As brothers and sisters of Christ and as the children of God. Now, verse 18, "Therefore comfort one another with these words." Brethren, this day is a comforting day. It is a day to rejoice. It is a day to be glad. It's a day to build hope and to look forward to the time when you and I will be born into the family of God. What a wonderful truth that is, that we are given symbolically through this Feast of Trumpets. Brethren, enjoy the feast. And let's rejoice in the fact that we are God's children.